Good afternoon, everyone. I'm the chair of this session, Uncle Dave Lewis. Thank you for joining us. The name of this particular session is Repertoire and Artists, Post-War Indies in Washington, D.C. Excuse me. Obviously, most of us have some familiarity with the situation with pre-war labels in the United States. After, of course, World War II, the landscape becomes increasingly more fragmented and regional, and I doubt that any of us can claim to really know all of the labels that were active in the U.S. after World War II. That's why we have these wonderful folks who have come to join us to educate us about the subject of bluegrass, R&B, and the rise of independent record labels in Washington, D.C. after World War II. And I have left my bio sheet where it does not belong. However, you are being joined by Kip Lornell, who is on this page somewhere. Wow, I am not sure. But to keep things, Professor Lornell teaches courses in American music as well as ethnomusicology. He also serves on the Africana Studies Program Committee. And prior to teaching at GWU in 1991, Professor Lornell had taught at the University of Virginia and the College of William and Mary. In 1995-96, he was a visiting professor at the Johns Hopkins University. He has more than 100 articles and record notes, nearly 30 record projects, several documentary films, and 10 books, most recently Shreveport Sounds, Arch-Latex Music, and Black and White, which was published by the University Press of Mississippi in 2007. He is being joined with a local record expert, Jay Bruder, and they are going to introduce their own panel members. Please welcome Kip Lornell and Jay Bruder.
Thank you, Uncle Dave. Hi, I am Jay Bruder, and I live in Alexandria, and I've been researching Washington area music for a good 30 years now. I'd like to introduce the people who've come in to work with us today. First is Tommy TNT Tribble, who recorded for both Gotham and RCA in the early 1950s, working with Mrs. Claiborne of DC Records. And then Dick Spotswood, whom you all know from many, many years at ARSC, as well as a radio host for WAMU. And Pete Kuykendall, the longtime publisher of Bluegrass Unlimited, and then Kip on the end. The format we're going to use today is we're going to present for about 20 minutes to give an overview on first rhythm and blues, and we'll play some musical examples as we go through. And then after that, I'll pose a few questions to TNT and Dick to talk about the R&B scene in Washington, and then Kip will come up and present on bluegrass, and then we'll do the same with Dick and Pete. So with that, let's get started. And thank you all for coming after lunch. Appreciate that. Many of you are aware of Washington's early association with recorded sound. And Tim Brooks and Sam Brolowski were kind enough to share this photograph of the Columbia Building. And Library of Congress shares on their website these photographs of early patent applications. But in the 1890s, Washington really was a hotbed for the recording industry. Unfortunately, by about 1910, there was little trace of that activity, and I have not been able to find any evidence of a real record label in Washington between 1900 and about 1946 time frame. Now, since we're talking about rhythm and blues, I'm going to focus on the African-American tradition in Washington, and there were artists from Washington in the 20s. Sis Quandar comes immediately to mind because I live right off Quandar Road in Alexandria, and the Quandar family is still very prominent in the local community. Claude Hopkins down there at the bottom, Claude Hopkins had to go to New York to record, but he was a very prominent band leader. Everybody cites Ellington, but there were many band leaders from Washington during the 20s and 30s. And then Chicken Wilson and Skeeter Hinton on QRS. Those two gentlemen recorded primarily instrumental music. They had to go up to Long Island, and these QRS records are, of course, very sought after today. But there's been a blues, jazz, and vocal group tradition in Washington going back to the beginning of the century. If you're a white and recording in Washington, you also had no major outlets. This Redskins record from, I think it's 1939, Dick, is that correct? Is well known because of the logotype. There were publishers in Washington, but if you really wanted to make a local record, you had to do something like this vanity pressing from Georgetown, and that's the only record I've found that properly is from Washington from before the war, other than acetates and air checks. It's not that there weren't studios. U.S. recording, shown by the tape box, was here going back to the 1930s. Sound studios into the 1940s. There are several other studios. Ben Edelman ran True Tone and later Empire. Edgewood was Ed Green in 1957. And uniquely, Washington did have a pressing plant, and that's Paragon Records. And we believe they were in operation from about 1946, 47 into about 1949. They were on Connecticut Avenue on the Maryland-DC line at Chevy Chase. Now, for African Americans, there was radio and TV exposure starting in the late 40s. I show here the lineup from WOK in the mid-50s, but in addition to that, there were TV appearances. And at the bottom, you see Bob McEwen with Frank Motley and his crew from 1954 when they were recording, when they were rather performing weekly on WTTG Channel 5 on the Dumont Network. And so that was a live dance show done 1954-55 here in Washington strictly for African Americans. It's, I think, precedent-setting, except for that Ahmed Erdogan of Atlantic reminded us in a recent book before his passing that there were live broadcasts from the Howard Theater for about 6 weeks in 1949. And unfortunately, because that was 49, they were not saved. Jukebox operators were extremely important to the dissemination of music after World War II, and I show here this Decca release, not because Decca is anything local, it's not, and Louis Jordan, certainly a national artist, but this record was resold by the Service Music Company, which was located in the Lincoln Theater building, and they overprinted all the records when they put them out for resale. The Lincoln Theater has recently been restored and is today a very prominent landmark in the African-American community here in Washington, and there were many, many other jukebox companies. Performance venues, certainly the Howard was the premier venue, but from the end of the war up until the mid-50s, there were lots of clubs, and we'll ask T to talk about some of them. There was even a beach, Sparrows Beach, and you could go out on the boat cruise on the Potomac on the SS Bear Mountain. And if you didn't want to catch Frank Motley 1 week, you could catch Dizzy Gillespie for a dollar. So lots of entertainment here in the mid-1950s. Certainly lots of record stores. Super Music was very prominent, but Waxy Maxy had quality music, and that was a big retailer here in Washington. And lots of mom and pops, as illustrated by Helen and Herb's. And that's, you know, there are dozens of those stores in Washington and in the suburban communities. There was, in fact, an African-American press in Washington, the Afro-American, the News and Observer. And the News and Observer put out this weekly sheet called Nightlife. And for the preservationists of you in the audience, I'd like to point out that there are only four copies of this known to exist. But this 1953 edition is volume 17. So just think about how many years' worth of weekly documentation of the music scene in Washington haven't yet been found and cataloged. If you think the situation is better for the national trades, not necessarily so. Billboard, of course, has a good continuous run and is available on microfilm, but the Cashbox does not. The best collection I have found is the Library of Congress, but it picks up in April 1949, and we know that Cashbox started publishing in 1942. So those editions survive only in the hands of individual collectors, and they do need to be compiled and made accessible. Washington had no shortage of talent. Anna Mae Wynburn, Tiny Davis, the Sweethearts of Rhythm had a house in Arlington starting in 1942 that they called the Sweetheart House, and they performed all over the country. They were a very significant touring act. But you didn't just need to have talent. You needed to have a motivation to start a record company. And you could argue that this was it. In 1946, the ceiling prices for disc records were lifted. And so instead of being able to charge 35 or 50 cents for a 10-inch record, you then had the ability to charge 79 cents or whatever you could get away with. And suddenly there was a real economic incentive to putting out records locally, and small runs of 500 or 1,000 might even make you some money. The first people to do this in Washington were the Feld brothers, and their name survives with Ringling Brothers Circus today, but they had Super Music and Super Drug, and they sold first Super Disc records. Kip will show you their big hit on that label, but moving on from there, in 1948, they sold their entire catalog to MGM. And if you remember that 1948 was the year in which the second Petrillo ban was enforced, MGM was desperately in search of catalog material, so buying out Superdisc really, I think, saved that label in their first year of existence. Scoop was a follow-on label and more local artists, and then in the early 1950s, they put their gospel quartets on quartet, and those are all very fine records and very, unfortunately, hard to find. We know of a handful of relatively undocumented Washington area records. The record on Supreme by the Lyles brothers, I have found in no references. I believe that this is the same Lyles brothers who were from Cardoza High School, an African-American high school in the district, in the late 1940s, and it's a very fine vocal group sound. The other one on Wicks, fortunately, was copyrighted. Howard C. Wicks was a very diligent fellow, and he went down to the Library of Congress Copyright Office, and we know that this record was from about December of 1946. The grand dame of the Washington recording scene was this woman, Lillian Claiborne. Mrs. Claiborne was from Winchester, Virginia. And she started with her partner, Haskell Davis, in 1946 to organize, and by 1947, she had her first records out. This title from Tiny Meeker, who was a society band leader, called A Moment of Madness, is a very appropriate leitmotif to her quarter century in the music business, because certainly she was a wild person, and she did some things that were well beyond the norm. She started with Society Records and Kitty Records, and as it turned out, found her greatest success with African-American gospel and hillbilly recordings. One of the first groups she had that really was successful were the Progressive Four. And this group was descendant from the Progressive Four group that recorded for Columbia in the late 1920s. What I'd like to do is to play an example of one of their religious songs that is actually parallel to the repertoire from the 20s. So if I could play track one, please.
The land beyond the river that we call the sweet word forever, and will only reach that shore by faith degree. Well, in that far off sweet forever, Lord, beyond that shiny river, when they ring golden bells for you and me. Oh, don't you hear bells ringing? Lord, don't you hear angels singing? 'Tis our glory, hallelujah, Lord Jubilee. Well, sweet forever, Lord, beyond the shiny river.
So when they ring the golden bells for you and me, for you and me.
And that's all too typical of these Progressive Four records. Very fine harmony and very coarse pressing materials, courtesy of Paragon Records. But the Progressive Four had some dissemination in, or dissension in the group because Mrs. Claiborne was pushing them towards pop material. And they eventually split up and formed new groups, and one of the groups was this group, the Captans. She first placed them on Gotham in Philadelphia, and from there she put them with Randy Wood at Dot Records in Tennessee and actually had a very successful record with I'm So Crazy for Love in October of 1950. This was popular through the Christmas season of 1950, and you can tell that because there's a piece of Christmas tape on the label. So this was obviously a Christmas gift. But there was some dissension again because the writer, Lester Fountain, one of the group members, instead of placing this record with Mrs. Claiborne's publishing house, placed it with a New York publishing house. Randy Wood got word of that and said, enough. And he dropped the group, and Mrs. Claiborne brought them back to Gotham. At that time, she had already engaged with our guest today, Tommy TNT Tribble, and she placed him with Ivan Balin at Gotham. And that went well for a few months, but she had a real coup. She negotiated a deal with RCA Victor, of course, at that time, considering themselves the world's largest recording company. And they put together a great band for Tommy and Frank Motley, the trumpeter, and had several releases. And I'd like to play one of them that shows TNT style at that period, and it's a little bit similar to Louis Jordan, but in its own way, moving on into the R&B period. So track two, please.
I get my kicks
in the country.
Yes, my kicks
in the country.
I get my kicks
in the country. 'Cause the city's too much for me.
Do you get your kicks
in the country?
Natural kicks
in the country.
I get my kicks
in the country. 'Cause the city's too much for me.
Way out in the open spaces, away from all the fancy places. You and I, sweetie pie, a hugging and a kissing on my eye. I get my kicks
in the country.
Natural kicks
in the country.
I get my kicks
in the country.
'Cause the city's too much for me.
Okay, there were some great people on that session. RCA wouldn't let TNT drum. They brought in James Crawford, late of the Lunsford Band, Frank West, not West, but West, the well-known saxophone player, and John Malachi, the pianist who worked for many years with Ellington. And the arranger was Howard Biggs, and then Frank Motley on trumpet. So it was an all-star session and a very commercial sound, but RCA was not very adept at promoting this type of music, as was unfortunately discovered by this group, the Heartbreakers. Mrs. Claiborne had hoped that this group would really take off in the era of the vocal groups. They had four releases on RCA, much sought after collector items today because unfortunately they did not sell. Her other prominent act was a man named Frank Motley, who recorded for a dozen or so labels in the 1950s, courtesy of Mrs. Claiborne. And she placed him eventually with Big Town, and this track down here called New Hound Dog is actually a follow-up on Big Mama Thornton's Hound Dog, and it's a transition between Big Mama Thornton and the Elvis Presley version. Not that Elvis ever heard this, but it was one of several recordings in that period of 1954 to 1955. But, you know, Washington's always been more of a jazz town than an R&B town. And there was a clipping from 1954 when Big Mama Thornton came to the Howard Theater to give you a sense of what the intelligentsia thought of R&B. Al Sweeney, who wrote for the Afro-American, castigated the public school system. And then he went on to say this about the music at the Howard, specifically Big Mama Thornton. It is hard to analyze this obvious breakdown in musical appreciation to the apparent level of morons. So, typical comments of a jazz collector about R&B. But nonetheless, a very vibrant scene here in town. The Clefs were another group that recorded for Mrs. Claiborne, and I'm going to skip one track here because we're a little tight on time and I want to be able to talk to people. But notice that she placed the Clefs with Leonard Chess as early as 1952, one of his earliest R&B vocal groups. And then finally, the Clovers. You can't talk about Washington and not at least mention the Clovers, who from their beginnings in 1950 with Eddie Heller's Rainbow label, and then further with Atlantic and eventually United Artists, were national stars. And I'm going to play a trick on our sound man and ask you to skip to track 4, please, on the CD. And we'll play a track from the Clovers.
Here comes Fanny walking down the street. She walks so groovy and she talks so sweet. Hey, Miss Fanny, you sure look fine. Tell me, please, will you be mine? Hey, now, Miss Fanny. Hey, now, please be mine. You've become my heart's disease. Listen to me, baby, please. You got me mad for you. Please don't drive me crazy too. Hey now, Miss Fanny. Hey now, oh, please be mine. Well, let's go out and have a ball. I love you, baby, and that ain't all. I don't care what your mama said. Let's have a good time anyway. Hey now, Miss Fanny, hey now, please be mine.
Okay, now everything starts to fall better into place when you realize that Miss Fanny was the wife of Bill Harris, the Clovers guitar player. And a lot of these records, which were national hits, had very local and specific meanings, and it's kind of fun to uncover that, and it makes us think when we go back to the 20s and 30s about the references we're missing from those recordings. One of the Washington standards is this called Mary Lee, and we don't have time to play it, but it's on many compilations, a very unusual record that's almost undanceable, but a standard of quarter hops when the kids used to come in each other's basements after school and pay a quarter to dance to records. The Three of Us Trio were another example. This label, PAM, was owned by June Norton, who was an Ellington vocalist. And the Three of Us Trio worked with Bob McEwen and the Capitol Caravan. They were the house band on the TV show. One of the most successful artists out of Washington in the 1960s was this man, Billy Stewart. And I'd like to play cut 5 and see if you can recognize this guitar break. Okay, a lot of people have said Mickey Baker from Love is Strange. The only problem is this record is 6 months before Love is Strange. And this was the product. No. This was a product of the Bo Diddley Band here in Washington, D.C. And I'm sorry, I've forgotten the man's name now, but it was Billy Stewart and Bo Diddley's second guitarist put that together. And the story of how that moved to Mickey Baker is another hour's worth of discussion. I'm going to wrap up the music examples. There are many more. Don Covey, who went on to some prominence in the 1960s, was from Washington. This Atlantic release featured the Little Richards Band. But there are hundreds and hundreds of other records from Washington from the 1950s. And with that, I'd like to turn to our guests. And TNT, if you could pick up the microphone, please. I wonder if you could just tell us something about Mrs. Claiborne and recording in Washington in the 1950s.
Jesse, Mrs. Claiborne, she was very inspiration. And she came to me, and she had Frank Motley, the dual trumpeter. In fact, I was surprised that one cat was blowing two trumpets, so I was anxious to get with him. And she got us together, and we played around and made some recordings. In fact, with the couple of little groups we made some recordings with. We had a good time, and right about now I can't go into all the places where we played, but Mrs. Claiborne herself was very inspiring, and she was demanding, and she went to work. She took me to RCA Victor, got me on there, and there was another guy named Jimmy McPhail. He had a place on Bladensburg Road, and I played in his club. He's dead now. But anyhow, I'm not going to keep on going on. This is something I'm glad Jay brought me down, and I can go on and on. The Hayloft days, Birdland, Canada. I've been all over. But I hope you all enjoy it. Jay. Okay, Jay? You take over before I say too much.
No, Jay, we want you to talk, and I'm going to pass to Dick now. And Dick, can you say a few things about Rhythm and Blues Radio in your misspent youth?
Well, I remember this gentleman's voice coming over the radio in, I'm going to guess it was 1951. I was about in the eighth grade and staying home sick from school and listening to Lord Fauntleroy Bandy. I can't do that very well because it's been a while since I've heard him. WUST's morning disc jockey who spoke with this very Oxonian accent. It was a total put on and very, very funny. Good radio guy. Pete, I suspect you probably remember him too. And of course, we had this wonderful talent. I didn't know Beans in those days. I had no idea that, you know, I probably lived within a long... Hello? TNT Tribble's house, you know, that he was my neighbor almost. Or that Jimmy McPhail or the Clovers or Ruth Brown or all of these wonderful people that were coming out of this very, very vibrant music scene in Washington in the late 40s and early 1950s making these wonderful records that were being circulated, but also showing as TNT's that wonderful record you played about living in the country, that we had a strong group of musicians here that you made them sound good and they made you sound good. That was a very, very strong record. So I heard that music. I loved it, you know, and I sort of, the bluegrass scene, which we will come to, didn't begin to flower until just a little bit later. But Washington was a very easy town where you could go back and forth from one of those wonderful genres to the other. And I'm sorry I'm so old now, but I'm glad I'm old enough to remember all that then.
Okay, Dick. Thank you.
Now, Jay?
Please.
Listen, I want to say one more thing. You know, back in those days, if you didn't go to New York or you didn't get involved with certain things, me, I just didn't want to try to go to New York and get tied up with anything in particular, and I stayed on my own. Like Jay said, I imitated Louis Jordan, or then I went to Gotham, and he told me to say, make your record sound like you having sex. I said, okay. I made a Hurricane Lover. But anyhow, back in those days, you have to work. And right now, I have a letter here from Collectibles. I get 1 cent a record, 1 cent, and they won't give me any more. I'm happy to be involved on the internet or whatever it is. Jay, taking it back over, like I said.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a couple more questions, TNT.
Okay.
You know, Washington at that time was certainly a segregated town. And can you tell us a little bit about the good and the bad of Washington in the 1950s?
The hayloft downtown, y'all are a little young to remember that. But anyhow, when I went downtown to play, I had traveled all over Canada, Cuba. In fact, I was in Cuba, and they took my whole limousine over there. And that's so before Castro got in there. And I was in Cuba, and I started trying to speak Spanish. Vina aquí. Anyhow, I can't talk too well because I have my teeth made. But anyhow, coming back to Washington being segregated, I played at the hayloft, and they used to sit the colored in the front and the back. And I said, no. I went to the guy. I said, can't you do better than that? I said, just let everybody come in. And sooner or later, they started letting everybody come in. And that when things started changing, all the clubs uptown theaters used to have just blacks going in or colors going in, they changed it over, and a lot of places lost business because things changed. But anyhow, I had a good time, and I have a good time now. Thank you, Jay.
Okay.
I want to thank Jay for bringing me over, and he's done a lot for me.
Okay. Great. TNT, thank you very much. And in an effort to stay on time, we're going to switch over now to the bluegrass side of the presentation. So a round of applause for TNT, please.
Mr. Spotswood will be back. He did such a great job, he decided he's going to stick around for the rest of today's show. Okay, I'm going to take the other side. And one of the reasons why Jay and I split it up the way we did, and I think I'm going to try to do this a little differently than Jay. Jay knows, and I've learned a lot from Jay about the independent scene here in Washington, and he set the background for some of the things that I wanted to talk about today. But I'm also going to go back into the 1920s, because if you look at country music in Washington, D.C., and bluegrass, you need to think a little bit about the prehistory of bluegrass, which really doesn't begin to become a genre in this country until the Monroe Band in the mid-1940s, and really didn't become a prominent, differentiated part of American country music really till the early mid-1950s. But there was country music in Washington, D.C., the Hillbillies on the left, and actually the Hillbillies to the right. Al Hopkins and his Buckle Busters and the Hillbillies were essentially the same group. These recordings from about 1927, early 28, roughly, for the Vocalion and Brunswick labels. The Hillbillies were an important band because they were the first to broadcast over WRC here in town, arguably the first country band to be based in Washington, D.C., the first country music band to perform for a president, and that would be Calvin Coolidge. They were among the first groups in country music to appear in a movie. That would be, a Warner Brothers short. And also one of the first to use an Hawaiian steel guitar. I should also add that, like Ernest Stoneman, who moved up here in the 1930s, they were originally based around Galax, Virginia. So we have Stoneman on the right, an early recording of Stoneman from late 1924, early 1925, for OK, and just to the left, Bela Lam and his Green County Singers. Green County is located kind of north and a little bit west of Charlottesville, not too far from Washington, D.C. If you go up 29 and the traffic isn't too bad. They made recordings in Richmond for OK at that time. We also have in Washington, D.C., this is a prelude to my colleagues from Smithsonian Folkways, who will be coming up here next. The Library of Congress was also doing folk song recordings, initially as field recordings, that some of which were released commercially on LP and eventually on CD. And this country gentleman
recording our live recordings done by the Country Gentlemen, which is an important bluegrass group from here in Washington, D.C. This is a Smithsonian Folkways reissue of Folkways material. This was originally recorded in 1962 and 63 and gives you some sense of the 78 era emerging into the compact disc era with Smithsonian Folkways, which I know Atesh and his crew will be talking about some. Baltimore and Washington, even though their proximity is close by, are two very, very different cities. And one of the things I want to do a little bit differently, Dick will be back here in just a minute. Pete, how well can you see that screen from where you're sitting? If you wanted to scoot over a little bit, if you could see it better, because what I wanted to do was to see if folks had, either Dick or Pete had things to say about what was actually up on the screen at the time. I can see Dick is already pointing. And to reiterate what I was saying, Dick, what I would be interested in doing is, as I'm going along here, if there's things that you and Pete wanted to comment on in terms of what I was saying or what's on the screen, or we will also be playing some musical examples, I would love it if you would jump in kind of contemporaneously as you see things, if you can think of anecdotes, stories, or commentaries that make sense. Wouldn't, in fact, if you can see better from sitting there, can you see all right from there? All right. So if things that are up there and you remember something you'd like to say, I think that would be an important thing to do. Ray Davis, longtime DJ and basement tape collector in terms of songs, and still broadcasting on WAMU, now emanating from his, I think, probably basement in West Virginia is where he's making those recordings. Johnny's Auto, was it Used Car Lot? Was that right? You're going to need that microphone there, Mr. Spotswood. Yeah, yeah. And there you go. Yeah, you each get one of those. You guys are used to microphones, yeah. You can't keep it, but you can use it for now. You have to give it back when you're done. Okay, so we have Ray Davis doing probably a recording that was done, Jay, 1957? 1954, as was the Blue Key recording done by the Potomac Valley Boys. From what I can discern so far from my... I'm kind of at the start of writing a book about bluegrass in D.C., so I'm kind of learning as I'm going along, and this is about the first public presentation that I've done. Jay fills in things when I get dates like that wrong, and I'm hoping that Pete and Dick have things to say about what I'll be showing here. But I did want to show Baltimore, much more of a blue-collar city, as much of a magnet for immigrants from the South and from North Carolina, Virginia, Georgia, West Virginia. It seemed to me that a lot of the bands from Baltimore tended to go up and play at Sunset Park, which is an important hillbilly park right near the Pennsylvania-Maryland border, more so than the groups from Washington did, although I may be wrong about that. Any observations on that one, Dick, in terms of where people went to play?
Well, this was before we had the interstate roads, and so if you wanted to drive up to Oxford, Pennsylvania, or Rising Sun, Maryland, which is where those two great hillbilly music parks were, you had to drive north. I don't even think the Baltimore-Washington Parkway was built yet. You had to drive north on Route 1.
No, that's you got it. Go with it.
Well, actually, I don't. I'm not as much of an authority here because I wasn't old enough to drive, but I got to ride with a few people that did. You had to go. You had to ride all the way into Baltimore up Charles Street, and then you had to turn right on Route 40, and go all the way through the city of Baltimore and get back on Route 1 again. And drive north just past the Conowingo Bridge. I believe that structure is still there, crossing that big, beautiful river. Dam? Well, you don't have to swear.
Hey, no, you know.
You'd get to this little park, you know, with a little stage with one microphone on it, and you got to sit on these unfinished planks that were on top of upturned cinder blocks, and sit there and watch some of the most heartbreakingly beautiful music that it was ever my pleasure to see in my life. The early 50s, mid-1950s, I mean, it was like rhythm and blues with TNT Tribble. I'd give anything if I could hit the rewind button.
Feld Brothers, their name came up earlier, and the hit that Jay was referring to is Guitar Boogie, which came out on Superdisc and MGM. Billy Grammer, Shenandoah Valley Boys, a bluegrass group, probably recorded in 1948, even earlier than I thought, I was going to say 1950. So there's a whole, the Feld Brothers also, as Jay put out bluegrass and country in addition to, and that 7th Street Boogie we're assuming probably refers to the 7th Street here in Washington, D.C.
Pete, can I add a little bit of background, relative bluegrass background? Relative to the tune that's up here, or the labels that are up here, if you look at the one on the right, Guitar Boogie, well, I have that, but there is an interesting sideman there. He was playing rhythm guitar, not lead guitar, because Arthur Smith was playing the lead guitar on the Guitar Boogie. But it was not the Arthur Smith, fiddling Arthur Smith, who was one of the major fiddlers on the Grand Ole Opry that they were all copying, going back to the Delmore Brothers, etc. Then there later came a songwriter, probably one of the major, major songwriters in country music. However, he kind of went directly into the marketplace. He sold his songs. He would write his songs and he would sell them. He was a native of Knoxville, and I could go into all that, but I won't. All right. I said all that to say this, as Ron Thomason would say. The rhythm guitar player on the Guitar Boogie, the Super Disc recording, most people don't think of him as a rhythm guitar player. It's Don Reno.
That is something I did not know. Don Reno. Reno and Smiley. Yep. Jumping back to Miss Claiborne again, and how busy she was with rhythm and blues and black gospel groups. Well, she was also busy with country. And recording Sleepy McDaniel and his Radio Playboys. And this time, in this context, the Radio Playboys was the radio station up in Frederick, Maryland. Notice the release number of the Paragon and the DC are the same, 8040. And if you look at that address can't be more than about a block or two into Washington, out of Washington, D.C., into Chevy Chase, Maryland. Yeah.
Look at you instead.
the fiddle player for Sleepy McDaniel at this time was a man named Buck Ryan. And I wondered when I saw the one on the right, because we'll come back to Orange Blossom Special here in just a second, Lee Highway Swing featuring Buck Ryan, I wondered how he ended up on a label that is, I believe, based out in Oakland, out on the West Coast, Los Angeles. Okay. Thank you, Chris. I knew it was West Coast, and I couldn't remember which Northern or Southern California.
That's the Claiborne collection, I think.
Apparently, Jay told me that. Is that an Edelman recording? Edelman Studio? Okay. Ben Edelman was active in his studio here in the 1950s, and that studio was in Tacoma, Maryland, right on the Tacoma Park, Maryland side, and the Tacoma, D.C., right up in that section, right very close to where the Tacoma Metro stop is now. He sold, apparently, a lot of masters sold or leased masters to Gilt Edge, which is how Buck Ryan ends up on a label that's based out in L.A. But Orange Blossom Special, which would be the first short musical example I want to play, Orange Blossom Special by Sleepy McDaniel on D.C. circa 1947, okay, earlier than I thought. So if you haven't, we've heard some R&B. Let's hear a little bit of the first track for me of Orange Blossom Special.
All aboard for a ride on the Orange Blossom Special.
And that is the Orange Blossom Special, first recorded by the Rouse Brothers in the late 1930s. And, no, Dick, I got the heads up from Jay that I needed to ask you a question about that. So what was that? You had something very specific in mind, Jay.
Because Dick has taken a hard look at the succession of recordings for Orange Blossom Special.
Okay, do you want to give us a quick chronology of that? Because I thought
just,
that was...
Yeah, just,
go ahead.
Just for the record, real quick, Tommy Magnus was the first fiddler to record that with the Roy Hall Band. There was some problem with publishing, and they didn't put that version out until the year 2000. The first published record to feature the melody featured a guy named Scotty Lawrence Wiseman, who's still living, but it was called The Train Song, again, because they didn't want to use the copyrighted title. Then the Rouse Brothers put out Orange Blossom Special. So it was the first, the Rouses put out the first published version of it under that title, and they, of course, were the putative authors.
Indeed. And what year did that Rouse Brothers
come? These are all in 1938-39.
Okay, I was thinking late 30s. Okay.
And then after the war, it seems to have just been recorded by 1,000 fiddle players on little rinky-dink labels.
Go.
A couple things about... Yeah, back up, please. Yeah, I won't go too far into this. Buck Ryan was, I'm pretty sure I'm right with this. I'd have to go back and look in the article we did on Buck. Buck actually was from Mount Jackson, Virginia, which kind of gives you an idea of the connection kind of with D.C. Secondly, and I'm relying on some long-ago memories for this one, I believe Sleepy McDaniels actually was the bass player with Hank Snow. Am I right, Jay? Okay. And came to Washington playing the clubs around D.C., and the significance about this specific recording is another musician who is on there that has a very, very large D.C. connection. And if you've been around this area, you would probably recognize it. He played accordion. His name was Jimmy Dean.
We'll be running into Jimmy later.
Okay. The other one, the Gilt Edge, there's an interesting story about that which gets me kind of covering a lot of different musical bases. I was born and raised in Arlington, Virginia. My parents, who came to D.C. for the government jobs, of course, were from Indiana. My mother was a frustrated pianist. And so she wanted her little kid to play classical piano. Well, her little kid was not interested in that kind of stuff. But he got interested in a companion to what was earlier, the R&B, etc. He got into Boogie Woogie. He was played on the piano, you know. Hey, rather than playing Rachmaninoff or Beethoven, I could play Boogie Woogie and drive her nuts. Well, I also got into record collecting about this same time. And one of the first records that I bought when there used to be a record shop, and I don't remember the name of it, apologize for that, down on 9th Street, I believe, or 9th and 10th, they were selling maybe used records, or they were selling what they weren't supposed to sell, which was the DJ copies that were given to the radio station so they would play the damn things. And anything else they could get, you know, off of the used record thing. Well, that has relevance to this one on the right. There was a guy whose record I bought at this thing, and I was probably, oh God, maybe 11, 12, something like that. And his name was Cecil Gant, which probably may not mean a thing to any, well, a few people here. All right. He got out of the service on the West Coast, and he got signed, so to speak, by a guy by the name of Bill McCall. And Bill McCall ran Four Star Records. Now, amazingly enough, this all will tie into Ben Edelman, the country gentleman, and bluegrass in Washington, D.C., and I'll tell you how. Gilt Edge was a subsidiary label of Four Star. The early records that Bill McCall put out featuring Cecil Gannon had one semi-hit called I Wonder. And on the back side of that was a thing called the Cecil Boogie. Well, now here's an 11, 12-year-old kid who's all hung up on Boogie Woogie piano, and he got this record for like 19 cents or something like that. Hey, this is kind of neat. So I became a Cecil Gant fan, but a good number of Cecil Gant's records were on Gilt Edge. It may have preceded Four Star. I'm not sure. Did it? Okay. Jay, you could probably fill in this question I have in my mind. How did K/Ben Edelman get affiliated with Bill McCall?
I didn't dig this up, but Margaret Jones, when she wrote the biography of Patsy Cline, talked to Kay Edelman. And Kay related that Bill McCall would make record foraging trips around the country where he'd go into studios and look for product because he had bought Gilt Edge from the original owners, he had Four Star, and he was very voracious consumer of new product. And as it turned out, Ben Edelman couldn't help but play the new Patsy Cline tape. Mrs. Claiborne had Patsy Cline under contract because she was from Winchester. They were homies. And as it turned out, McCall took Patsy Cline, and then that kind of left Mrs. Claiborne out, which explains how the R&B started showing up on Big Town, which was then a Four Star subsidiary. So it was Pats. It was Patsy Cline that caused this whole thing to go round and round, and Bill McCall just working the country to the various studios looking for new material.
Okay. Now, having said that, this is getting awfully convoluted and linked and all those other things, and I hope you can follow me if it bothers me. Not you. You can jump in sometime. I assume we'll have questions. Bill McCall, one of Bill McCall's salesmen, okay, selling 4-Star Records, who was a native of the state of Washington, got out of the service, World War II, I think, and he was looking for a job. Bill McCall hired him as a sales manager. This may go over a few heads, but I hope you'll get it. His name was Don Pierce. Yep. Now you start to see all the interconnection there. Don Pierce got in with Pappy Daly and Jack Starnes, who was a hillbilly producer of shows, I think, down in Texas. And they started, Houston? Okay, thank you. And they started this record company, and it was basically a combination of Star and Pappy Daly. Jack Starnes, Pappy Daly. Star Day. And that's where the name came from. But, sure, I'm getting a field here. Am I ahead of you or?
Keep going.
Oh, no. Okay. All right.
That's a mistake.
Keep going in a truncated way.
All right. They had one major hit on Star Day by a guy who most country and hillbilly record followers will say probably has one of the top three country voices in the world. His name is George Jones. And his hit record was, Y'all Come? No, that was already Duff. Why, Baby, Why? This moved a lot of product. And Don was a salesman. So, I'm getting a field, but anyhow.
Okay, I know Chris wanted to say something, but I'll tell you what, in the interest of time, I'll catch you after this. You can correct... It was something about Big Town that you wanted to say, but we'll forge ahead and I'll catch up with you after this. The Erdogan brothers, sons of the Turkish ambassador here in town, ended up with material essentially from Washington, D.C. because of their time here in Washington. The Howington brothers played around town a lot in addition to recording for D.C. and Atlantic, and they played at some of the best known places in Washington, better known than the Kennedy Center today among certain circles. We had the Dixie Pig, and Jay suggested the one at 1998 Richmond Highway was the bigger one, and the place where bands were most likely to play. Crossroads Restaurant is where the Howington brothers played for many, many years, up until the early 1970s, and that's not too far north of where the University of Maryland is, probably about 8 miles north and a little bit east of where we are now. 1963, November of 1963, at the New Famous, Patsy Stoneman and the Troubadours, one of the many Stoneman family groups was playing around here in the 1950s. And I decided to toss that other one in on the bottom left to just give you some sense. Milk Grant ran a teen dance show, but Hootenannies in 1963 were important enough that in terms of the folk and folk revival, that particular club, which is very close to the White House, was featuring folk music of all kind. Not only the Anchorman, but you notice in the bottom left, Dave Van Ronk was playing there. And if I could toss a little bone out to my colleagues again at Smithsonian Folkways, one of the projects they did was a Dave Van Ronk reissue, and collaborated with Dave both in the selections and writing the notes for that. And Dave, unfortunately, has passed in recent years. Edgar Cassidy, Arlington, Virginia. Anybody that, did you know Edgar Cassidy? Because we assume that he was from Arlington. Is that somebody that you ever knew, Pete? Oh, pick up that microphone if there's something you want to add, because he's a mystery to both Jay and I.
There were a number of migrants from primarily Southwest Virginia, government jobs, construction trades, settled primarily in Manassas Park and Pimmett Hills, Falls Church. But they brought their music and the love for it with them. And I'm pretty sure, if my memory serves me, which it sometimes doesn't, I'm pretty sure that Edgar Cassidy was from Southwest Virginia. And didn't he do an album for Ben, for MZM?
For one of those drugstore long plays.
Okay. This is very traditional sounding bluegrass. We think from about 1952, 53, somewhere. And this is actually the second, if you could hit the second example on that CD, we'll hear Edgar Cassidy.
You said that you loved me and I was the one. Why did you go and leave me all alone? Won't you come back and start life anew? Will you love me, darling, just as I love you? You know that I love you with all of my heart. Please tell me, darling, why did we ever part? Won't you come back and try to be true? Will you love me, darling, just as I love you?
Okay, I'm going to kind of skip ahead here. Mac Wiseman touches on D.C. bluegrass, but not in as important a way as some of the other folks. D. Stone, not anywhere local, but his recordings were important around here. Mutual Records from around Martinsville. We'll come back to Blue Ridge here in just a minute. Bluegrass Champs, very significant in Washington, D.C. in the mid-50s in terms of extended members of the Ernest Stoneman family. Remember that Red Label OK we saw earlier on, Ernest V. Stoneman? He and his wife Hattie moved up to the D.C. area in the mid-1930s, and they had, if I'm not mistaken, no less than 13 children, most of whom played music, and they ended up playing in groups like the Bluegrass Champs. And most of these photos, which come from Jimmy Case's website, are from circa 1955, 56, 57 in that area, right along in there. And I'm hurrying along partly because of time, but also I wanted to get more to Buzz Busby, who was an important figure in all this. And I'm also, just to give the sound man a heads up, we're going to skip off to the number 5 selection here in just a minute so that you understand what we're doing here. Buzz Busby, originally from Louisiana, and from Monroe, as we say. My spouse is from Louisiana, so I can say Monroe the proper way. Recorded in Washington, D.C., started a group here in about 1954. Eventually, of course, the Country Gentlemen ended up kind of splintering off. Charlie Waller, 1957, forming the Country Gentlemen. But the one really traditional thing that, as soon as I told Dick I was planning to play it, he said he gave me the 2 thumbs up for playing Pretty Polly, because it's a really strong and fairly archaic performance by Buzz Busby. You mentioned Star Day. There's a Star Day recording by Buzz, Reno-bound, and then an independent production by Buzz Busby, which I'm thinking is probably late 1960s, but I don't know that one for a fact.
More like
Dick?
70s.
Early, okay, in the 1970s. Let's listen to Pretty Polly, though, which was recorded for Empire Records.
Polly, won't you take me in town? Polly, pretty Polly, won't you take me in town? Come sit here beside me and I'll tell you my mind. My mind is to marry and never to part. My mind is to marry and never to part. The first time I saw you, it wounded my heart. Willie, little Willie, I'm afraid of your ways. Willie, little Willie, I'm afraid of your ways. You're rambling and gambling to lead me astray. He led her over mountains and valleys so deep. He led her over mountains and valleys so deep. Polly mistrusted him and then began to weep. She looked around behind her and what did she spy? She looked around behind her and what did she spy? A newly dug grave with a spade lying by. Polly, pretty Polly, your guess is about right. Polly, pretty Polly, your guess is about right. I dug on your grave the biggest part of last time.
Jay wanted to reminded me that not only was Ben Edelman's shadow all over this in many ways in the 50s, that Empire Records was recorded. That would be a studio recording by Edelman and a label owned by Ben Edelman. If you look at the address on Cedar Street, that is up near the D.C., once again in Tacoma, right near the D.C. and the D.C. Maryland line. Buzz Busby, there's a man named Tom Minty, who lives up in Rockville, has been working on a Buzz Busby biography for a while. And I went up to see Tom about a month or so ago. And I think probably Buzz is one of the more interesting and well-known figures as, in terms of individuals and well-documented figures. I'm assuming that both of you knew Buzz, and especially Pete. Did you ever play with Buzz around town at all? Okay. Anything you wanted to add about these recordings or about Buzz himself? And if you do that, you'll need to, if you wouldn't mind picking up the mic. We've got a couple minutes left because we need to time certain stop in just a few minutes, so this is probably going to be the wrap-up in terms of time. Anything you, either one of you wanted to say about Buzz?
Yeah. I'm not sure how to tie this together because I sometimes get a little bit convoluted. I apologize for that. I'll point out, since you've got it on the screen here, notice the writer credits on Reno Bound. Oh, okay. It's B. Harrell, H. Harlow. Dick and I were discussing this, and we're about 98% sure that H. Harlow is another pseudonym for K. Edelman / Ben Edelman. And the basic deal that where Ben got in on the whole thing was Ben had a studio in the house where he and K. lived. This is before this. Or the Pretty Polly and the Tacoma Park thing, because I recorded up there a number of times. He had a MagnaCord PT6 rack mounted, a couple of probably U47 tele microphones, and a tin ear. But he didn't charge anything to the artist. But the deal was that if Ben recorded you, K Kay Adelman, or various pseudonyms, got half writer credits, even though she didn't write a damn thing. If you notice any of the Country Gentleman records, you will notice C. Davis or Cindy Davis. Guess what? Another Kay Adelman alias. This was in the days when BMI was starting to put a real pressure on ASCAP for the performance royalties. And one of the ways they did it, which is another whole story, but I'll do it later, was ASCAP was not interested in the African Americans or the hillbillies. They were interested and mainly controlled because it was writer-owned, so to speak, writer-publisher-owned, by the Tin Pan Alley Boys. That's the reason that you do not find very many ASCAP songs, with one exception. You've had it up here already. I'll do one other quick aside, and I'll tell you I'll drop the other shoe on the ASCAP. If you look at some of the old records, and if you notice, none of these up here that are have it. Around the circle, it says not licensed for radio broadcast. Now, you all remember that? Look at some of your 78s. Not there.
No. Take your word for it.
Yeah, take my word for it. Take my word for it. It might be on the Gilt Edge thing, possibly, but we'd have to blow it up. Anyhow, the reason for that is because the people that wrote it were not affiliated with ASCAP because ASCAP wouldn't let them in. They were damn hillbillies. What do we need hillbillies for? We got guys that are writing songs and all that up here, and that was part of the copyright law of 1909. And I'm digressing, so stop me. I had one other thing I was going to comment on. Oh, wait a minute, huh?
Name of the song.
Name of what song? Oh. You said
you were going to tell
us. The name of the song. And it's still. Can I see a show of hands? There was a, I think it was it PBS? There was a PBS program on the Orange Blossom Special. Trains. Anybody see it? No. Shame. Ovation Channel. Well, guess who is an ASCAP writer? Irvin Rouse. Well, who also, this is a DC connection here. He played, because I played not with him, the bluegrass band that I was playing with played at a club at, I don't know, 11th and 8th Streets. We would play for, a 40 or 45 minute set. And then Irvin and his brother Jack would walk around the tables and play for tips. Well, Irvin had a substance abuse problem pretty bad. But I'll say the one thing. Did any of you ever see Scott Stoneman play? The Bluegrass Champs? Okay, there's one back there. Did you ever see Scotty do the trick fiddling? Irvin had two major hits, songs. Orange Blossom Special being one of them. The other one was called Sweeter Than Flowers. Anyhow, they would walk around and playing acoustically now, no electric. Jack, the brother, one of the brothers, had a Gibson Electric that he had taken the pickup out of to where you could put the dollar bills and the quarters into the hole where the pickup was. And that's what they played for. But I said all that to say this. Maybe once or twice, they did, the two of them, did the trick fiddling thing, and I guarantee you they would flat out shut down any bluegrass festival in the world with that show. And that's where Scott got it from.
I should have talked a bit about Connie B. Gay. That's not a pseudonym, by the way. Don Owens and Blue Ridge and a number of other issues, but Time Master has taken over. And I don't want to take any more time away from Smithsonian Folkways because we've taken our time. I'd like to thank Jay for his help on this and, of course, Mr. Spotswood and Mr. Kuykendall. And that closes us because we're out of time. Thank you.